Austin Grant to introduce our speaker.
Okay, great job. Thanks, Vicki. And thanks, everybody. Thanks to students for the great work they've done, which is what we're celebrating at the event here today. Every year we've had a keynote speaker, and they've been very distinguished, and I'm really happy to have another distinguished McGill alumnus here. Dr. John Small is our keynote speaker. He's professor in the Department of Biology at Queen's University, where he also holds the Canada Research Chair in Environmental Change. He is a paleolimnologist, so for him, lake and river sediments are archives of long-term natural and human-related environmental change and can reveal long-term changes in aquatic ecosystem. His recent projects include the long-term effects of lake eutrophication, acidification, contaminant transport, calcium decline, fisheries management, and climate change with a special focus on the Arctic. The impact of his work reaches beyond the ivory tower. He's a frequent commentator on environmental issues for radio, TV, and print media. If you scan just the last 2 days of publications in even such high-quality journals as the Montreal Gazette, the Globe and Mail, or National Geographic's Daily News, you can find coverage of his research. His most recent paper reports that aquatic ecosystems in Canada's Hudson's Bay lowlands, one of the Earth's most southern Arctic refuges, have undergone dramatic climate-driven changes since the 1990s and may have reached an ecological tipping point. The list of his prizes and distinctions is too long to read, but I'll read a few of them to you. He's been honored by many of Canada's top scientific acolytes, the Stacey Prize, the Gerhard Herzberg, the gold medal from NSERC, 3M National Teaching Fellowship, 3 honorary doctorates, and earlier this year he was named an Officer of the Order of Canada. He received his PhD from Queen's University in Kingston, his MSc from Brock, but his first degree is a McGill BSc in Marine Biology from 1977. So, you'll see that Professor Small is an excellent example of how McGill's science degree provides the passport to the future. And so I'd like to invite Dr. Small to present the keynote address entitled Advice to Young Scientists on Thriving in a Complex World. All yours.
Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you for that very nice introduction, and I'm very happy to be here. It's always nice to come back to McGill University. It's a very sort of nostalgic walk down through the Rottick Gates and everything. I used to come here every day. It's kind of interesting. The first class I ever went to was in the arts building in this part of the campus, so it is somewhat nostalgic. Of course, I'd also like to thank all the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. And what I was asked to talk about was to provide some personal perspectives on advice to young scientists. Although working with young scientists is what I do all the time, whether it be in the teaching or in the research side of what a university is, the sort of the two academies, if you like, talking about what you do is sometimes a lot harder than actually doing it. And it's something that's much harder than hard to explain about. So it wasn't really that simple a task. I've gotten pretty used to giving talks about climate change in Hudson's Bay and the effects of the oil sands on local lake ecosystems. So this was a bit of a difference for me. Also, I don't normally have notes when I speak anymore, but I decided to make myself some notes because it isn't, again, a sort of a regular kind of talk. I purposely tried to make this talk also a little shorter so we can have some time to discuss it if there is anything, or if not, we can always go and have a few drinks. But the topic I said is advice to young scientists on thriving in a complex world. And I work in the environmental world, this, in some way I'm going to be reflecting my work. I think that's all one can do is the world you live in. I work on environmental issues, and I believe, and it isn't just true for environmental science, but all types of science, I would argue that science matters more now than ever before. Science has become part of our lives. It becomes how long we live is dependent on science. How bad our water systems are treated depends on science, or how well we can stop our waters from being treated badly or air being treated badly. The technology we use, it's all dependent on science, and this has really become a much more important issue over the last few years. I will have a sort of an environmental slant to what I talk about because this is what I do. And I think we have to start realizing that we live in a multiple stressor world. And I think this relates to almost all the posters I saw out there. You may not be directly in an environmental field. You might be in the medical side. You might be in the physical geography side. But one thing we have to start realizing is we are in a complicated world. And when it comes to environmental science, we're in a very multiple stressor world. We have climate change happening. We have contaminants coming in. We have different types of stressors. And this requires scientists who think clearly on their feet and have an understanding of broad spectrum of issues. This is what's the real requirement of, I think, a solid undergraduate program, one that I think you'll get here at McGill University. But it's absolutely critical to have informed citizens, and a prerequisite for a functioning democracy is to have informed and engaged citizens. And I'm hoping that's what they do in universities, and I'm pretty sure that's what's happening here. It's also further complicated. We don't really know where we're going sometimes. And when, again, it comes to environmental issues, in some ways we've opened Pandora's box. We've released all sorts of things, and we don't really know where this is going to lead to. I also preface this talk before I get to some of my points in that I believe we are in difficult times in this country. And this is a university. I am going to present some things that are meant to provoke. I think this is the privilege of being in a university. You can present strong opinions, and I think I will present some relatively strong opinions here. That doesn't mean anyone in the room has to agree with me, but that is a place where we have an open discussion as to why I am wrong. I do think we are living in a country right now where science is being put sometimes on the backstage. This is the protest that was at Parliament Hill just over a year ago, often called the Death of Evidence or the Death of Science rally. We had a smaller one just recently at Queen's University. I think we have to be very careful how science is used and the requirement for science and evidence-based policy. And so our role is not just to produce the science, but to make that science accessible to politicians and the public at large. And that'll be one of the themes I'm going to try and present here. That's not to say we're supposed to be talking always about policy. I think there's a place for science and there's a place for policy. They are two separate things. But policy should be evidence-based, and evidence, a lot of evidence comes from science. I have these talks where I criticize the political system right now, and I realize that's not really what I'm supposed to be doing here. So I thought I'd stop on this point and just say it's very easy to criticize politicians, but we as scientists, as a group of scientists, we have to take some of the blame. And part of what I'm going to try and do in this talk is to provoke some action and to show that there are things we can do. It's very easy to say, well, there's nothing we can do. Well, there's a lot we can do. There's a lot we can do in getting more science-based decisions into policy. There's a lot we can do about climate change. There's a lot we can do about human health. All the posters out there that were related to somehow human issues, there's a lot we can do. We just have to do it. So what I did is I put together a bunch of suggestions. I mean, these are suggestions. I'm not saying this is the way to do it. I am no expert on these things. I'm looking back at my career. I consider myself still mid-career. I still got time to go. But I believe that these are some suggestions that have helped me, or I think that I've been following with some productivity. So I just thought I'd pass them on here in sort of this relatively informal talk with no charts, no graphs, no equations, just a few words. And I listed these as suggestions. The first suggestion I had was, I think it's very easy to start underestimating the importance of what we do. We should never underestimate what we're doing in science, or it's not going to be just science, in academia, in issues that relate to research or anything else. We have to realize that great ideas can change the world. It could be great scientific ideas, it could be great ideas in literature, and any other thing. And I see a large part of my job as a teacher and a researcher, so basically a professor is usually both teacher and researcher, a good part of my job is to channel ambition and vision in this creative process we call science. You know? But I think at the same time we're channeling this vision, we have to continually demonstrate, by example, the importance of maintaining a strong moral compass in what we do. Science and other forms of scholarship can and do make a big difference. We should never underestimate the importance of what we're doing. Quite simply, for a democracy to function effectively, it needs an educated and an active citizenry. And this is what universities do. In universities, we transform lives. Great ideas can change the world, and it's an important catalyst. And when it comes to great ideas, a lot of it's simply based on research, much of what I saw in the posters out there. With research comes empowerment. As Alvin Toffler said, knowledge is the most democratic source of power. Now, sometimes it's very easy to think that what you're doing is just such a small part of the big picture. And in fact, I talked to some students at their posters, and they were almost apologizing. Well, this is, you know, really quite minor. And of course, all the research we're doing is a small part of the puzzle. That's how science moves forward. It's nothing. This is what's required to have progress. And history of science is full of research examples of how small pieces of the puzzle were brought together to produce great discoveries and produce great ideas. To back up to how I started this talk, do not underestimate what you are doing. What you are doing is important. It's important to you, to your careers, it's important to the world around you. If you are doing good science, you are doing something important. And that's one thing I get worried about also when I talk to my colleagues in academia. I think professors are famous for being cynics or cynicism, you know. We say it all the time, oh, I'm working all the who cares and that. And I think that's, for the professors in the audience, I'd like to challenge them as well. I mean, if we keep saying, repeated that, oh, who cares about what we do or no one really cares about our research, well, you repeat it often enough, people believe you. And I don't think that's really true. I think if what we're doing is important, we should keep emphasizing that it's important. My second point is do something you love. Enthusiasm is an important catalyst. I couldn't help thinking when I walked through the posters out there of how enthusiastic the students were, how enthusiastic you were. Don't lose that enthusiasm. That will keep you going forever. You can use this excitement of discovery to build on your own enthusiasm, the enthusiasm of others. This can go a long way, not just in research, but also in communicating the results of your research to the public at large. Basically, enthusiasm is contagious, and I've seen this in labs. You have enthusiastic labs, and you have non-enthusiastic labs, and to some extent, the leadership has to come from the top. But if students get excited about learning these new concepts, that keeps me excited, and keeps everyone in the lab excited, and collaborators excited, and that's really something that's very important. Some of these are all sort of rearranged in any thing, but some of my suggestions here are more practical even. I mean, one thing you'll find, I think, as you go through your career, and you've probably already found already, time is your most important commodity. Time is something that you can't take back once you lose it. Doesn't mean that you have to be working all the time, certainly not saying that. But if I had one piece of practical advice, being well organized can save you lots of time, and it's a very worthwhile investment. Now, we tend to learn by example. I sometimes think I learned by negative example. I'm not going to mention which of my supervisors, wasn't McGill professor, but this sort of is the desk of, you know, one of my supervisors. The only thing you could actually find there is the cup over in the right corner. But what I'm saying is just a piece of practical advice. I mean, when we do research, being organized can save you lots of time, and time is really as critical as to what you're actually going to end up doing. So much for the practical advice. But when it comes to doing research, one thing that I think by suggestion number four, you know, we spend a lot of time getting answers. When you talk about research, I have to get this answer, I have to get this answer, I have to find out how to get that answer. You know, getting answers in science is actually not that hard. I mean, relatively speaking, it's obviously can be a lot of work, and you might say, what's this guy saying? I was there all last week and trying to get my data out. But the real challenge is to ask the right questions. Big questions get big answers. And I think we should be spending a lot more time to think about what questions we're asking than actually answering this process. I say this is a key advice for young scientists on process. We have to start avoiding what I might call the reinforcement syndrome. Well, so-and-so showed it here, and I'm going to show it here. That's fine, but it's kind of turning the crank. A major part of my interaction with students is to make them appreciate what their data can tell them. I continually challenge my students with the statement, stop telling me what your data can't tell you. Tell me what your data can tell you. Why are your observations important? In almost every data set, you can find things that are important. Stop concentrating on what it can tell you. Along these lines, when you come to start asking questions, I think it's far more important to be right than to be interesting. And this is one of my biggest fears, especially in my field in ecological and environmental work. I'm seeing a growing trend where some people seem to believe it's more important to be interesting in projecting yourself as a deep thinker and revolutionary, but being boneheaded wrong. Science and scholarship is about getting answers, defendable answers. Now, I certainly don't want to in any way suggest that you shouldn't ask. There is certainly no shame in framing bold hypotheses. In fact, we should. That's exactly what we should be doing. There is shame in not using the available data to form these hypotheses. Basically, what I'm saying is ignore other people's observations at your own peril. I live in a world in environmental fields where we have all these, obviously challenge is part of the scientific process, but that challenge has to be based on a solid foundation. There's kind of time theft going on sometimes up there, especially if you get into some more prominent areas like climate change or something. You spend a lot of your time defending things that don't really need much defense, but it's based on people, my view is, trying desperately to be interesting without the database to be behind it. You sometimes hear the word maverick. Oh, that's a Pat Maverick or a contrarian or something. Well, be careful. The label maverick has a short shelf life if one does not produce. And very quickly, the word maverick is replaced with nut. In summary, what my main point is, dare to challenge, certainly dare to be wrong, but your ideas have to be constrained by reality or the data that is already out there. Well-placed confidence is important, but not blind confidence in one's presumed abilities. Confidence based on a foundation of well-thought-out research and solid, defendable data and observation. Undoubtedly, some of our conclusions, given the period of time that follows, will be shown to be wrong. This is all part of the give and take of science. But as long as our conclusions were built on well thought out and properly collected data, reproducible data, you have still contributed to the process. There's no dishonor in being knocked down. There's only dishonor in not getting up again. Now, if you are going to ask questions, it's always better, of course, to ask an interesting question than the boring question, but only if that interesting question is answerable. Science is about getting answers. Science and other forms of scholarship is about getting answers. And again, but if you certainly do everything you can to try and be it in an interesting way. My seventh piece of advice is to try and keep an open mind. Be flexible. This can go in many different directions, but for part of it could be don't be too restrictive on how you think science should be done. There are different ways that research solves problems. For example, in many branches of science is classical hypothesis testing. In fact, that's the foundation of almost all science. But, for example, I work, much of my work is in the paleoecological field. I look at long-term trends. I can't do classical hypothesis testing because I don't have true controls. What I do is I look at patterns of data collected in a meaningful and scientific manner, and I look for patterns. I look at defendable patterns, reproducible patterns. From that, I make conclusions. There are many ways to gain knowledge, many ways to do science, and I don't think we should put ourselves into different ghettos as which is a proper way of doing it. And often, as a result of this, it's often very good to be outside your comfort zone. Often this is where you get new ideas, new challenges, new technologies. Little conferences such as this is a classic way to do it. Sure, you have to stay at your poster for a time, but look around, see what else other people are doing. That's where you make collaborations. That's where you get a lot of new ideas. It's only once you get into step out of those comfort zones, you'll see. I always like this thing. I don't know if you see the line back there, but yeah, don't forget to look around. You might actually find something interesting. This is a very serious problem, not just in science, it's a problem in government. It's a problem in a lot of other type of research or other types of institutes. A classic argument I have to deal with is always in the government, where we have these different departments set up. And, I'm dealing with a water quality issue. Well, that's a Department of Environment issue. And then I have the fish are dying because of the water quality. Oh, well, that's natural resources. And then, they're dying because of acid rain. Oh, well, that's, that comes from the atmosphere. That's a whole different department. The problem is we don't have the luxury of, putting up these silos in different areas and not talking to each other. We have serious problems on this planet, and we have to start dealing with them. I think T.S. Eliot probably said, only those who risk going too far can possibly find out how far they can actually go. Related to these silos or something, we also shouldn't set up ghettos in science. All good and honest science is important. If it's good and honest science, it's worth doing. And, you know, it's no such thing as, oh, well, that's a better type of science to be doing. If it's science, if it's getting defendable answers, it's worth doing. And, you know, I have various bugbears over my career, but one of the classic ones is this never-ending debate about basic versus applied science. This was ongoing when I was a student. It's still ongoing to some extent. I'm going, why do we put ourselves, why do we build these ghettos? It's almost like it's this teeter-totter of basic versus applied. I'll use my own career as an example. When I was hired by Queen's University, going back 1980s, a long time ago, my PhD thesis was on looking at using lake sediments to look at the long-term histories of lakes going back 12,000 years. Now, what could be more esoteric than that, one would think? Looking back at how a lake was 12,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 9,000 years ago. Anyway, Queen's hired me, which I'm very happy about that. Shortly into my career at Queen's, acid rain became an issue. Suddenly, we had a real challenge out there. One of the biggest problems with environmental issues is the lack of long-term monitoring data. We don't know what conditions. How do we know, just use the acid rain example. You could go to places like Algonquin Park or go just south of where I work now at Queens, Adirondack Park in New York. You could go and measure the pH of lakes and say the lakes are acid. Well, very similar to our climate change debates happening on, the same arguments were made there. Yeah, they're acid, but they've always been acid. Or it's just part of a natural long-term cycle. Well, how do you prove they weren't always acid? The only way you can do that is find out what the acidity levels of these lakes were like before acid rain. We have to find out what the pH was like in the early 1800s or 1700s. Well, that's going to be a challenge. First of all, Sorensen only invented pH in 1909. Secondly, certainly no one was measuring the pH in Adirondack Park or Algonquin Park in the 1700s. So the methods we use with lake sediments, we could reconstruct paleo pH meters and show that, yes, indeed, the lakes have acidified, it's not part of a natural cycle, and so on and so forth. This little diversion is to tell you, in a period of about a week of time at my career at Queen's, I went from being totally basic to totally applied. It happened in my university in a week. From being the most esoteric guy in the building to be, well, you know, John, he just works on these applied issues. I'm the same guy using the same methods. The main difference between basic and applied research is a matter of time. All basic research will eventually be applied in some way. I'm convinced of it. It's the foundation for the applied research. So it's not, why do we set up these ghettos and saying, well, that's applied or that's basic or, you know, that. If it's good, solid science, we don't have the luxury to set up problems where they don't exist. Basically, the main difference between pure and applied research is just a matter of time. While we'll be doing our science, I would argue that we always have to be prepared for surprises. And sadly, our expectations are sometimes betrayed by observations. And I think saw a few posters there that I think the observations that we finally had weren't quite what we were expecting. Now, in science, we're not supposed to expect an answer. You know, we're supposed to be completely blind. But you know, let's face it, we want a bigger bang and so on and so forth. Well, this life is like this. My argument here is don't get too emotionally attached to your hypotheses. You may cloud your judgment. And all scientists such as myself with the graying hair all know examples, perhaps even in our own lives, of how we've hung on to a hypothesis too long or a pet theory. You know, it's such a beautiful hypothesis, if only it wasn't ruined by the data. But it's serious, you know, and we all know some who are doing this for 15, 20, 30 years, and it's sad. But you have to learn to let it go. It was a good idea, it just didn't work. But it can really start clouding your judgment. I think all of us, especially the senior scientists in the room, have examples, perhaps even in their own lives, but certainly of colleagues that have just hung on to ideas that just weren't right and hung on to it for too long. Keeping in mind, we have to always realize that doubt is the scientist's only certainty. You always have to doubt even your own data. You need to have the maturity to move on to new ideas and release your pet ideas from there. Also, while you're doing this, realize that there are often differences between the real-world examples and what is written in textbooks. And again, I saw some of that out there. And I'm guilty of this, too. I read a lot of textbooks. I read a lot of books. And, you know, people are showing me a graph on their poster, and then they say, well, it's not as good as it looks like in a textbook. Well, let me assure you, when you're writing a textbook, you scour every figure you can find until you find the best example. That's because you want to make a point in your textbook. That's not the way the real world runs. And in fact, we have to be careful with the culture of precision versus what is possible. Realize that what data you collected is the way the data are. That doesn't mean that what you've done isn't as good as what someone else did. A good example of this is some of you, I think, were doing meta-analyses, looking at many, I saw one example, he's looking at many different data sets. And I always say meta-analyses, when you look at other people's data, you try and put it together to get a big picture. It's the data everyone loves to hate because it's so easy to criticize, because so-and-so didn't do it exactly that way or exactly that way. Well, of course not. But again, let's appreciate it for what it is. There are some issues when you start combining data sets from 100 authors. But if we can't see a pattern of something important, then the pattern's probably not there. And yes, as we saw out in some of the posters, sometimes we get negative results. But negative results are still critical to the overall scientific process. I think Thomas Edison, who I think most of us would agree was a kind of successful guy, I'll always love this quote, "I have not failed, I've just found 10,000 ways that it doesn't work, it won't work." Every time you find negative results, you've added to the process. Make it known so someone else doesn't do it again and waste time finding the same data you have had. Negative results are always part of the overall process. When you're out there and science works by criticism, it's something we're not really used to. But the only reason we put our work out there in publications and in conferences such as this is to get criticized. The only way we move forward is because of criticism. Criticism is what basically makes the science move forward. And they also have negative implications. No one likes being criticized. But I think I will quote my ecology professor here at McGill University from the 1970s, Robert Peters, who sadly died at a very young age in his 40s. But I always like this quote from one of his books. "We hone our theories and research until they are as keen and sharp as they may be. The whetstone against which we sharpen our tools is criticism." Science is self-correcting. Science works by falsification and challenges. We have to have the maturity to deal with this. And when you're going to go out there in the scientific world, whether you go on in teaching or research or some other aspects, the only way we move forward is to present your stuff and have other people criticize it, find out what they think is wrong with it. Once, eventually, something very little will be wrong with it, people will start believing you. And I think Ben Franklin probably said it also quite well, "Critics are our friends, they show us our faults." And that's the only way we move forward. There are lessons to be learned from being wrong, and we should share those lessons. There's nothing wrong with it. It's the way the system runs. Now, having said that, while I'm talking about criticism, just as there are positive aspects to criticism, it's the way science runs, there are positive ways to criticize. And perhaps the best way I can put this, I don't know if any of you have submitted any work yet or so on and so forth, but what publications would you typically do? You write your paper, you submit it, it gets external referees, it comes back to you. These external referees are often done anonymously. And in the future, if you may have already done some reviews or you will be doing some reviews, my general advice to my students, and I've been an editor my entire adult life. I became an editor when I was 30 years old, so I'm still editing another journal now. But I was like looking at some reviews. I learned a lot about the way people do reviews of other works. I learned a lot about what they're like, frankly. And I always use this advice. When doing a review of someone's work under the cloak of anonymity, think about how would you feel receiving that view. Or state it more plainly, anonymity is no excuse for being a jerk. By the same token, when you do get reviews, you have to look at them as an opinion. A review of someone's work is nothing more than an opinion. It can be challenged. It has to be challenged with other data. But most of the criticism you get should be taken in a positive way. Why did this person not understand, or is there really a fault in the work? That's something that we always... It's a very difficult thing for many scientists, even at my stage or at the... mid-career or later, we still get negative reviews, and, you know, I wake up 4 in the morning, oh, who was that? You know, of course, you're going through the list of names of who could have written you that review. As an editor who's been editing since he was 30 years old, I can assure you, if you try to guess who the reviewer is, 95% of the time, you're wrong. When you're editing, people write back and they're angry at the review. Well, I know who this is. It's so-and-so. And I'm sitting there, nope, no, it isn't. So, but just it's just part of the maturity of going through the scientific process. This one I've been getting a little more sensitive to, especially starting writing somewhat more controversial papers. If you're going to criticize a paper, at least have the courtesy to read it. And this is becoming a growing problem. People are, you know, it's so easy now. There's so many papers. There's a lot of papers out there. And there appears to be a growing number of people citing papers that they've never read. One paper cites a paper. And it's a little, you know, it's probably okay. Someone cites that paper, but they're citing the original paper via the filter of the first person who cited it. Goes to another point. It reminds me of that game children play. You know, the telephone game? It's like a party game, I guess, you have with your kids. You tell 1 5-year-old a little story, and then he whispers it to the next kid. By the time it goes to the 10th kid, it makes absolutely no sense to how the story started. This is how some of these things are passing through the literature. People are clearly citing second or third, fourth time something cited, and they just think they know what the first person said. If you're going to criticize, or even going to cite a paper, please read the original paper. This only adds to the confusion of science. Here's another piece of personal advice. If nature or circumstances throws you a soft-moving softball, bat it out of the park. It may never get it. You may never get a second chance. And by that I mean, don't kid yourself. Being first is important. I often hear this about, you know, some of my colleagues. Oh, that scientist is so lucky, always first to get the major studies out. You know, my view is the amount of luck out there, it's kind of equal. I think what the difference is, there are people there who take the initiative when they see they've actually have a slow-moving softball coming towards them. And there's people who say, oh, wow, I got a really big discovery. I'm going to sit around and no one else can possibly get this discovery. And I can look back at about, the 10 papers I'm most proud of, which I think were high-profile papers. I think in almost every case, once my paper was published, within a few months, the same types of results were shown in other people's work. It's just like people were just sitting on their data and just not getting out. Don't kid yourself. First is important. And the reason these people are ready to put their right, I think Louis Pasteur said it very well, in the fields of observation, chance favors only the prepared mind. You have to be ready to understand that you have something important. And then once you have something important, you know, don't kid yourself. Being first is important. Now, if you're second, that's still good, and third. But you're shifting from explanatory to confirmatory science. And, of course, you want to be more in the explanatory rather than confirming or challenging the science in the first place. And try and avoid the turning a cramp. At least, you know, we have to do it sometimes, but don't make a final study of it. Some students especially seem very reluctant to publish. Now, some of that are to present their results or publish or bring it to conclusion. Some of that is understandably caution, and we should be cautious. We don't want, once it's in print, it's there forever, so we have to be careful. Some of it is simply procrastination, I think. And some of it is not quite having the maturity to realize there's no such thing as a final study. There's no excuse for not publishing if you have solid data and you can make reasonable conclusions. If you can do that, it's time to publish. Yes, you may be wrong. Yes, someone will show you that you're wrong. But as long as it's based on solid data that was carefully collected, thought out conclusions, which is taking into consideration the data that is already out there in the foundation, no one who's a serious scientist should fault you in any way. But as I say, potential has a shelf life. So eventually you've got to get that stuff out, and it's best being first. And when we're talking about here, we shouldn't also kid ourselves in research and scholarship. It sounds a little, you know, highbrow research and scholarship, but don't forget that we have products like everyone else. It's not just simply the ivory tower. All businesses, all jobs, all careers have some sort of product. If you're a research scientist, your product is typically research publications, conference proceedings, helping graduate students. But there are products, and every job has products. And Scholarship can only exist if we communicate our findings, whether that be in conferences or, more importantly, in publications. Products are important. Don't let anyone convince you otherwise. I mean, if a tree falls in the forest and no one sees it, did it actually fall? Well, say, if you did science and you never told anyone about it, does that science really exist? You know, if that science isn't published in some way or some record of it, that science doesn't exist. So it's never been done. So think about that, about the weekends you spent doing that. Within reason, maybe not like this, make your work known. Some passive self-promotion, I think, is desirable. What do I mean by passive self-promotion? There are many ways that once you publish something, you can make it more known than perhaps in the past. There's various types of websites that, you know, hold documents. You can send your PDFs, take a proactive role in sending your results to colleagues who would be interested. Their idea, oh, if they're interested, they'll find it on their own. I can assure you, you get pretty busy very quickly. You know, pretty well the only thing I find is that people shove under my nose right now because I'm doing all these other jobs. So some passive self-promotion is always a good idea. When it comes to making the results of our research known, communications of our research do not end in the classroom, laboratory, or campus boundaries. By and large, the public has paid for this research. They've paid for it with their tax dollars. They have a right to know what they paid for. They have a right to know what you've done and why it's important. And that usually takes an extra step after the publication process. More like public education, whether it be talking to seniors group. I talk everywhere from kindergarten students up to seniors, to politicians. And I think this is critical. We often complain about how we don't have enough research funding, universities aren't funded enough. Certainly at some point, we have to take the responsibility for some of this. We have not done a very good job of telling the person with the jackhammer or serving the Tim Hortons coffee of why part of their check is going to pay for facilities such as this. We often use the excuse that people aren't important in what we do. This is nothing but an excuse, I'm convinced of it. I've been spending quite a bit of time talking to public, talking to politicians. I'm convinced that politicians and the public at large are interested in science. They're very interested in science. They're almost typically under-informed, sometimes misinformed, but they are definitely interested. And politicians want to know what we're doing with their money. And we should start realizing that one of the reasons we're not getting all the maybe resources we want is partly our fault. Certainly other people are making their products known or their results known. I mean, I deal in the environmental field, and if I didn't make the results of our environmental science known, certainly much of the industry that I'm often at odds with is certainly doing a very effective job with communications department, public relations department, and so on and so forth. I have no choice but to do. By effectively communicating our research, we can also impart knowledge of the culture of science and other forms of scholarship. Not just the products, but how science is done. There really is a misunderstanding often of how science is done. Basically, what I'm saying is science is not really a democracy where every opinion gets a vote. A good theory or a good idea in science is not based on a vote of which theory do you prefer. It's based on how much reproducible data can be used to support it. This is something sadly lacking in certainly a lot of media outlets and also in the public at large. I mean, I deal with a lot of climate change research. I'm there on television or wherever I'm at talking about, thousands and thousands of top-notch science papers. And then, then the other 50% is someone with a website. You know, anyone who has a URL address now is a publisher, basically, or so it seems to be. Very effective communication strategy with a lot of money often behind it. But, why is a paper in Nature or Science or the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences put on the same footing as someone's website? It just isn't. We're comparing apples and oranges, and we have to start realizing science doesn't work that way. It has to be based on a solid foundation. Of course, things should be challenged. They should be challenged all the time, as I said previously, but it's not really how it works. Show by example from the work we do that research is critically important to society and that researchers can influence political and other decisions. You know, saying, oh, there's nothing we can do about it, that's a pretty easy cop-out of actually not doing anything. We can make a difference. There's many examples of people making a difference. But again, due to generally poor communication skills or not wanting to do the communication, often we're not doing it effectively. Now, when we are communicating, we're going to have to start choosing our words a little more carefully. We in academia are very bad at using words, I'm finding, and I've been trying to sort of try and change how I change my words and so forth. Here are some examples of how some lobby groups and others use words. This has now gone defunct, but the Advancement of Sound Science Coalition. That sounds like a pretty solid organization. They were based on fighting tobacco regulations. It was mine. Friends of Science. I'm a friend of science. I was pulling out my Visa card. I think I'll become a member of that. And you have the headlines like greenhouse gases, biggest hoax of the century. These are the words that we're up against. What are some of the words we use at academics? We use things like curiosity-based research. Now, I'm not saying if you hear of any of my writings, I am one of the strongest proponents of fundamental basic research. But who thought up the word curiosity-based research? I mean, what does the general public think when they hear curiosity-based research? These words are important. These phrases are important. These are words that politicians read. We should be a little more careful on the types of words we use. Call it fundamental research. Call it basic research. But be careful. We basically have to learn to speak their language, especially if you're in a thing that is polarized, and much of my work is polarized, working with environmental issues. We have to learn how to, I think, speak their language. And I was recently on a panel, one of the seven-person panel to investigate the water monitoring in the tar sands, now called the oil sands. Yeah, that's another thing. They changed the name. Everything when I was on that panel, it came down to money. Say, well, you know, that's going to cost $2 million and so on. I got two pieces of information from the ministry of the two units I would discuss money with. When you go to the oil sands, if you're ever there, these monster trucks, they're enormous. You can't look anywhere without seeing 20 of them in a row. Each of those trucks is about $5 million. That became one unit of measure. Saying, well, that's going to cost $1 million. And I say, well, that's one-fifth of a truck. Another unit I had was a spare tire. A spare tire is $50,000. So, you know, I'd say, well, that's only one spare tire, two spare tires. You almost have to bring it down to the language of money where some people understand. And, you know, and who knows what the advertising budgets are? That's the other thing. You know, if we don't start making letting our research be better known in the general public, certainly there's other people making other things known. I mean, we've all seen these ads. I grew up on a farm, and this is for the tar sands. And I know what it means to have land restored. I've been to a lot of the tar sands. I'm not quite hard to look at. I grew up in Montreal East, and I know something about I know something about bullshit. I'm not a farmer. I love this one. What oil sands mean to all Canadians? Hospitals, doctors. Yeah, that's good. We're going to need more hospitals and doctors. If you look at some of the data coming out. Why does it always have to come, the economy versus the environment? Again, we've done such a poor job of explaining that the environment is critically important to the economy. If you look at the cabinet table in Ottawa, you just look who's sitting around the cabinet table. The environment is integral to virtually everyone sitting at that cabinet table. I mean, forestry, fisheries, tourism, the economy, of course, health, all these things are intimately associated with the environment. Why is environment always seen as a cost? It's an investment, just like education. People see education as a cost. It's not. It's an investment in the future. But it's not the way we've presented our work. We have to start explaining the true cost when it comes to these things of any decisions, including environmental cost. We need a new accounting system where one can use the atmosphere. One can't just use the atmosphere as an open sewer, for example. I always love this quote from John Kenneth Galbraith. I say this, well, my friends are economists. I'm not making fun of economists, but he had a classic line. The only function of economic forecasting is to make astrology look respectable. I say this because when I do talk to politicians, they always bring up the economic forecasts and the economic models. They say, well, you know, you and your scientists with your error bars, we can't make we can't make decisions based on that kind of accuracy of your models. Well, I don't know how the economists got so much credibility. I mean, they dress better than me. I mean, these are the best clothes I've got. But I think it's dressing or something. I don't know how they've managed to get the politicians believing the economists, but they don't believe the scientists. I will gladly put my environmental model error bars next to any economical future I'm not sure what predictive power they've had, to be perfectly blunt. I think our predictive power has been rather good. We've predicted the acidification of lakes, the recovery of lakes when the acidification stopped. I think our models are pretty darn good on many of the other environmental issues we're dealing with. Why is this information not getting, why is the credibility not there? Everything comes down, well, how much is that going to cost? It's not how much it's going to cost to do something. It's how much it's going to cost not to do something in the long term. We just have to get this information across. And this is something that we really do have a responsibility. Scientists do have the responsibility to communicate their findings even when they are unpopular. And I admit a lot of my, I wish I could sometimes bring good news. Almost everything I find to the table is bad news. But it's bad news that's important. If you're gonna have some medical issue, it's best to know about it, how to deal with it properly, how to solve the problem. And this is getting to be a serious problem, I think in this country especially. I'm getting very concerned with some of my colleagues. You know, there's three major groups of scientists in this country and other countries. One is industrial scientists who have their job to do. That's fine, but they're bound by what they're doing for industry. We have government scientists, and I don't want to get too much into what's happening to the government, but I think we've all seen a lot of the headlines. I was in Montreal a year and a half ago at the International Polar Meetings, an international meeting on Arctic, and all the government scientists were followed around by these, not followed around, but they, before they wanted to talk to the press, they'd have to have their communications people sort of almost like a referee to make sure what the questions were like. We're hearing all a lot about muzzling a federal scientist. The only thing left is university scientists or academic scientists. And I'm getting very concerned. We're starting to see self-censorship. I've talked to some colleagues saying, wow, you should talk about that. That's important. I said, well, you know, I've got this strategic grant coming up in a few weeks. I'm going to need a letter from such and such a department in the government. You know, maybe I'll talk about it later. I mean, if academics start self-censoring, we're finished. We're the only ones left. So I think that's a very serious issue. And I think Rachel Carson probably said it best, often seen the mother of the environmental movement when she wrote her, at that time, controversial book, Silent Spring. Knowing what I do, there would be no future peace for me if I kept silent. People, if you have data that has to be told, you have to bring it forward. And yes, sometimes you do have to throw stones at giants. And finally, I'm just going to conclude, research and teaching or whatever you do in your careers is fun. A general guideline I have is I try to laugh out loud with my students at least once a day, though probably they're usually just laughing at me. But what I've presented here, just to conclude, is some personal perspectives. I'm certainly no expert on this. These are just ideas. We're in a university. This is where you present different views, where we can provoke, discuss. But we as scientists do have exciting and in many ways privileged jobs. These are pretty good jobs we've got. We live in exciting times. We have exciting positions. Teaching, research, communication, they're all critical components that are required to achieve the goals of a functioning democracy. We need, as I've said a few times here, we need informed and engaged citizens. That's how a democracy actually runs. We really should embrace these challenges, and we owe nothing less to our colleagues, to our students, and to the public at large. So thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Very nice. Now we have time for some questions. I think, I don't know if we have any microphone. Oh, there's a microphone right over there. And just come up to the mic and ask a question, and John will answer.
Hello. Thanks for speaking. It seems like a lot of what you're advocating is to not worry about reputation and statistics, your roster, and to just focus on science and what science is supposed to do. But at the same time, if you want to have the opportunity to do that science, you need to get a job in science. Mm-hmm. So how do you balance the pressures that are forcing you in opposite directions?
Yeah. Well, there'll be pressures throughout your entire career. A good way to get a job in science is to make sure the products of your research are out there, so publications and things like that. And certainly, if you're looking for an academic job, I think making your research known, or it doesn't even have to be an academic job, doing some of the things I think I've said here will not hurt you, making your research known and why your research is important. But you're right. Getting good positions in science and has been difficult for a long time. It's gone up and down. I can assure you in the 1980s it was actually statistically worse than it is now. And things are actually opening up, I think, right now. But no, it's obviously a balancing act of what is practical and what you can do. But I think most of the advice I gave you here isn't going to keep you from getting a job or getting a career. I think much of the advice I see here, if done based on a scientific foundation, based on data, not just opinion, but based on data, will get you the job you want. I don't think anything I said there will be a major deterrent. But I may be naive. There's other professors in the audience. Maybe they think I'm totally naive.
That's actually how you get a job, is by doing good science and publishing.
You know, yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, people, I'll give you an example. When I get attacked often for climate change work or some of the other work, they say, one of the first things they say, well, that's, you know, well, of course, you have to say that. The only way to get ahead in science is to follow the lead, which is absolute nonsense. You don't get promoted. You don't get for turning the crank. You get promoted or whatever your career advancement is, not by following the lead. You get it by doing new, exciting things that are defendable. The other thing I hear, the only reason you do that is to get grant money to say climate change is still a problem, which is, again, another, I think, nonsensical issue. I'm the one who's saying we have enough research to take action. I'm not the one saying we need to. I'm saying it's time to take action. Research is in. So you have to be ready to defend the criticisms you get.
Thank you for your talk. I'm just wondering if you can share with us any observations you've made over your career about how science is funded differently since, you know, when you began and today, and how that's affected how science is done.
That's a very good question. The question is, how has science funding changed since I began my career over 25 years ago, I guess? It has been changing. It has been changing, I think, not often to the better. There's been a trend towards having unconstrained funding, and we still have, in Canada, to be blunt, we still have the NSERC, what are called discovery grants. These are grants that professors can apply for. Probably most of the work funded out there was from discovery grants. These are still, we're still protecting them as much as we can. These are grants that a professor can get for a five-year period. And it's called, you still have to say what you're going to do and you have to defend what you're going to do. But once you get the money, you can change what you're going to do. They're open-ended. And this is exactly how science works. I don't know what I'm going to be doing in 5 years. I'm going to a conference and I completely change, you know, many directions in what I'm doing. This is an amazing way to get great bang for the dollar for science, because that's exactly how science works. Having said that, those grants are not big. And much of the other funding that is out there is what's called directed funding or partnered money. And a lot of this is moving very much towards industry or industrial sponsors in some ways. Even, for example, the strategic grants program and so forth. So they want to, you know, interrelationships with industry. And certainly there's all sorts of science that there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing that. Large sectors of environmental science makes perfectly reasonable. If your research is how to make a better carburetor, I see nothing wrong that Ford is funding that or funding a good part of that or perhaps in some partnership with NSERC. There's lots of areas of science that there's very good reasons to have these partnerships. If you work in a field such as I do, environmental science, which is almost always at odds with industry, I can assure you I have no big rush of industry coming to my door offering me money to go and find out the effects of the tar sands or to affect, you know, or how much pollutant this is causing. I don't see that money actually coming in. And so large areas of the funding pie, and the funding pie is kind of the same, they're just making different recipes for part of that pie, is being excluded from some scientists. And I think that's a very worrisome trend. The only real thing we're hanging on to are those NSERC Discover grants, and they are critical to having real fundamental basic science going forward. And if anyone wants to just fund applied research, that's just absolutely ridiculous. We've seen this, the issues happening in the National Research Council. They've now become sort of, they even call it like a, it's almost like a, you know, a cafeteria for industry. And it sounds good. When you say it, well, why shouldn't the government-sponsored science be for the good of industry. Well, of course, to some extent, of course, and no one's going to disagree with that, but not at the exclusion of all the other forms of science. Not all science has an immediate industrial or economic gain. It will in the long term. All good science will eventually be used in some way. But we're like a pyramid, and the foundation science is at the bottom, and the applied science is on the top. The applied science is totally dependent on that foundation of basic science. We can't lose that basic science. And some people say, well, other countries will do that basic science. How embarrassing do we want to be as a country? We are a G8 country. I mean, we pride ourselves on our economic status, but we're ready to let, all the other countries, like Portugal and places like that, do the basic science, and we'll just use it and take the applied and use it for life. Are we not embarrassed when we make statements like that? I am, as a Canadian. I'm still a very proud Canadian, but I'm getting less proud.
John, I think there's only time for one last question. It's mine.
I didn't see it. I'm looking.
I just made it up. So if you were to give advice to our government, and if they're listening, or advice to academic administrators who occasionally talk to government people, what would be the advice that you would like to provide for what our government should do to take a leadership role in science in the world?
Well, that's a big question. The basic advice I would try and continue to hammer into politicians is that there's tremendous bang for the buck for investing in universities and investing in research. Research and education are not costs. They are investments. But they only show up on their Excel spreadsheets as in the debit column. As this is, and somehow, miraculously, we have a highly educated workforce that pushes the economy of Canada forward, but somehow the credit doesn't seem to come back to where that came from, which is universities. And the same with the pure and applied research, how a lot of what the economic gains of a country like Canada come very clearly from that foundation. Now, we've said that often. I'm not saying anything too original, but I would just keep hitting them over the head with that and hope that we have people who will listen. I think that's the best we can do.
Well, with that, I would like to thank John. Now, this kind of Vanna White moment where I give John a thing. Oh, it's to show the McGill.
Oh, McGill. Thank you very much.
Thank John, but I'd also like to thank all the students who made presentations today, not only the ones who won the awards, but all the darn posters out there were great. The supervisors who helped do the research. I'd like to thank Victor for his hard work in organizing the events all day today. And I hope to be able to talk to some of you and John as well. Well, not, I've already talked to John, but John to talk to you guys out there over a glass of wine or something. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.